Hello, everybody, and welcome back to episode 7 of the Effective Altruism Forum Weekly. My name is Colin Snell. This episode is going to be covering the top posts on the EA forum and some of the best commentary and comments from the 31st of October through the 6th of November, 2022. Thank you all to the entire team that's helped me put this together. Zoe Williams, of course, writes these summaries that I adapt, and the team is also expanding, so many thanks to everyone involved in that process. So without any further ado, let's go ahead and jump right in to this episode. Starting off, as always, with the philosophy and methodology section, this week we have an entry called An Introduction to the Moral Weight Project by Bob Fisher. In 2020, Rethink Priorities published the Moral Weight series, a collection of 5 reports addressing questions around interspecies cause prioritization. This research was expanded in May 2021 through October of 2022. And this is the first in a sequence of posts that will help to overview and outline this research. The author's summary, which has been lightly edited, is, quote, "Our objective is to provide moral weights for 11 farm species, under assumptions of utilitarianism, hedonism, valence, symmetry, and unitarianism. The moral weight is the capacity for welfare that is calculated as the welfare range, or the difference between the best and worst welfare states that an individual can realize at time X, multiplied by lifespan. Given welfare ranges, we can convert welfare improvements into disability-adjusted life year equivalents." End quote. The author then goes on to note that this will allow making cross-species cost-effectiveness analyses possible, which currently, within existing models of effective altruism, efficiency, and effect, are really, really hard to do. The next post we have is by Joel McGuire, Michael Plant, and Samuel Dupret. A Dozen Doubts About GiveWell's Numbers is the title. This is a collection of 12 critiques of GiveWell's cost-effectiveness analyses, or CEAs, confusingly titled, given Center for Effective Altruism, also going by the same acronym. Nonetheless, out of these 12 critiques, 10 applied to specific inputs for malaria prevention, cash transfers, or deworming, and 2 are relevant for more than one intervention alone. These critiques include potentially relevant studies not being included in GiveWell's cost-effectiveness analyses, a lack of granularity in terms of country, age, and gender differences in analyses, and questioning some of GiveWell's assumptions around income improvements from malaria prevention. The authors also include a spreadsheet with their modified cost-effectiveness analyses. And next, we actually have another article about GiveWell's cost-effectiveness analyses, this one titled Quantifying Uncertainty in GiveWell's CEAs. And this is by Hazel Fire, Hannah Rockbrand, and Tanay. In this article, the authors have quantified the uncertainty in GiveWell CEAs by translating them into Squiggle, which allows putting a number to uncertainty on each parameter. This in turn allows calculation of the value of further research in comparison to donating directly to current expected top charities. They find that the value of perfect information on each of GiveWell's existing charity recommendations would be around 11.25% of GiveWell's total budget. They also discuss specific parameters that, if we were able to pinpoint them, would have the most impact on reducing uncertainty. Things like average number of midwives trained per year is key to reducing uncertainty on Katherine Hamlin Fistula Foundation cost effectiveness, as well as others. Possible improvements to this analysis are discussed, and notebooks with the code for each of the top charities are also provided. And next we have an article called A Theologian's Response to Anthropogenic Existential Risk, by F.R. Peter W.Y.G. This is a report by Catholic priests on how the Catholic Church can engage with long-termism and play its part in advocating existential risk security. It was written for a Catholic publication and introduces many of the basic ideas from that angle. The author argues that technology, things like nuclear technology, have equivalence to, quote, eating the fruit of the tree of knowledge, and is one example of an anthropogenic existential risk, or AXR, which threatens the death of mankind. By failing to mitigate AXRs, humanity could fail to live the fullness of life God would otherwise will for it. This also includes many biblical references that suggest a promise of a large future. In this way, the author argues that Christian motivations can make a great contribution to mitigating AXRs by providing reasons for costly action toward that goal and resources put towards that goal. I also do really strongly recommend going to this article and reading some of the suggested edits as well as comments down below. It's quite a fun time, and it really helped to break us open as a community to a worldview that many of us might not have appreciated as much as we really could have. So thank you very, very much to the original author. All right, now moving on to the object level interventions and reviews of other ideas. The first article we have is Map of Biosecurity Interventions by James Lin, which is a visual map of what people in biosecurity are currently working on that also has some accompanying notes. The topics covered involve not just global catastrophic biological risks, but also interventions targeted at COVID-level pandemics, which arguably can affect existential risk by destabilizing international cooperation, creating institutional distrust, and a myriad of other issues and limitations on day-to-day action that can help mitigate existential hazards. And the next article we have asks the question of how effective are prizes at spurring innovation? This was posited by Rachel Norman, Tom Hurd, Jenny Kodomoa, and Bruce on the A Forum. This is a literature review by Rethink Priorities on the effectiveness of prizes in spurring innovation and what design features of prizes are the most effective in doing so. It largely focuses on inducement prizes, which are defined as having a clear award criteria that's defined ahead of time, and they also compose about 78% of all prize money in 2007. They found that there was little evidence on counterfactual effects in the literature, with most articles focused on historical case studies. Two studies found positive effects on intermediate outcomes, numbers of patients, direction of research, etc. The next category they looked at were recognition prizes. These are things like the Nobel Prize. And these had a surprisingly large positive effect on the number of publications, citations, entrants, and incumbents for prize winning. However, there's also evidence they might be concentrating scientific attention on a very narrow range of scientists, as well as ideas. There was little evidence and very little consensus as well on how to design prizes to make them the most effective at motivating desired outcomes. Cash amounts had only weak relationships to output, prestige provided a stronger incentive, and other contributing factors also affected this. Diverse participants really, really did help outcomes, and economic theory suggests inducement prizes are the most helpful when the goal is clear, but the path is not. While simultaneously, the market's failing to provide the incentives to come about certain solutions or scientific discoveries. The authors write that a closer review of recognition prizes, advanced market commitments, and grand challenges, things like funding grant proposals with additional support if they're successful, are all suggested routes to improving the effectiveness of these types of prizes. The next article we have comes from Animal Ask and Ren Sprilinga, called The Challenges with Measuring the Impact of Lobbying. This is a summary of a report by Animal Ask that assesses if academic literature contains quantitative estimates that could be useful in gauging the counterfactual impact of lobbying. In other words, this article looks at a report by Animal Ask that looks at if there's any existing educational literature that can help us gauge whether or not lobbying is an effective area to put our resources. This requires breaking policy success into a baseline rate and counterfactual increase from lobbying. And the answer that the authors found is quite striking. They found the answer to be no. Lobbying literature contains many well-known weaknesses. A systemic review found a strategic result with a narrow range around 50% success, possibly because there are often lobbyists on both sides of an issue. And only one study attempted to identify counterfactual impact, and only for one specific policy. The authors instead suggest using expert judgment and super forecasters to help make up for the challenges of measuring the impact of lobbying. And oh boy, the next article we have by Lucas Lewitt Mendez and Aaron Boddy is called What Matters to Shrimps? Factors Affecting Shrimp Welfare in Aquaculture. I also love this piece because it's almost the psychological version of Thomas Nagel's What's Like to Be a Bat, which of course asks a question that's pretty central to philosophy of mind, and I won't drone on about, but I really love this article and what it's intending to do, especially because it is just a report by the Shrimp Welfare Project on the importance of various factors for the welfare of farm shrimp. So shrimp welfare can be measured via biological markers, things like chemicals associated with immune or stress responses, as well as by behaviors. Avoidance or aggression are two examples of potentially not exactly the most flourishing shrimp conditions. Scientists can also tell the welfare of these shrimp by what their body or physical conditions are like, as well as their survival rates. In addition to disease and stunning/slaughtering these shrimp, as well as inefficient dissolved oxygen or high unionized ammonia in the water that they're living in, the scientists found that one of the greatest sources of harm to shrimp welfare was eye stalk ablation. Many crustaceans, when trying to be bred or propagated, will have their eye stalks cut or damaged in a way that can promote maturation of the reproductive gonads. And the authors argue that eye stalk ablation, as well as the stunning and slaughtering processes, as well as the inefficient dissolved oxygen or pionized ammonia in their water, are all areas that the shrimp farms can probably improve, and in turn improve the welfare of said shrimp massively. Next, moving on to conflict, we have the article How Bad Could a War Get? By Stephen Clare and Rani Martin. This post attempts to find the likelihood of an extinction-level war by A, examining whether the distribution of battle deaths follow a power law, and B, what would this look like in the extreme tales? Other questions are also proposed, things like, if a war has already killed 90% of the human population, is it plausible that it would continue? The authors found that a power law is a plausible fit to the distribution of battle deaths across wars, but other distributions like log normal fit just as well. We also have little information on the upper tail because we haven't had extinction level wars, a common thread in existential risk analyses across the board, and we also have few examples of world wars. Theoretical reasons for extinction level wars to be less likely than a power law suggests include increasing pressure from the public to end the war as it grows in impact, increased logistical complexity hampering the very largest of potential wars. The authors also argue, conversely, that with new technologies come new abilities for us to destroy ourselves, and they also can remove barriers and means that otherwise would stop us from having an upper limit on how bad a war could get. These technologies include nuclear weapons, bioweapons, artificial intelligences, as well as other emerging technologies that might not exist yet. Now, jumping from war to politics, which, of course, some politicians would very melodramatically say is not that large of a jump, whereas any soldier or person who's ever experienced a war would probably say, it actually is a pretty large jump between the two topics. We have Should We Be Doing Politics at All? Some Very Rough Thoughts by Holly Elmore. In this article, Holly Elmore argues that engaging in political campaigns has some major risks to effective altruism. These include things like corruption risks, which result from certain incentives to lie and misrepresent political interventions that come with political action. Additionally, some political interventions age really poorly or might lock EA and EA organizations into specific particular positions. High leverage, that is big impact for few resource campaigns, are likely less democratic and risk major blowback against effective altruism or the cause areas in question. And also, high leverage methods used previously, things like ballot measures, are now under question because of the ease of use for special interest groups. However, effective altruism might also overstate the threat to epistemics. Usually we bucket the theory of change or selecting interventions separately to doing the intervention and allow more leeway in the latter. This results in certain charities, for example, needing to use bribes and using bribes to operate in certain countries. And in this way, political campaigning is much more doing than prioritizing. And it's also a straightforward public demonstration of commitment to our goals and values, which could have expected value returns that are quite high, the author notes. The next article might be a bit of a wake-up call for any entomophagy fans, that is, people who are fans of eating insects, and it's called Insect Farming Might Cause More Suffering Than Other Animal Farming, and it's by Ishan K. Heyer. The edible insect market has been growing rapidly and is projected to continue to do so. The author made a guesstimate model in this post that approximates the cricket suffering per kilogram of insects consumed. The author found that the insect sentience multiplier would have to be 10 to the negative 4th for the days of suffering divided by kilogram to be around the same as a chicken. Based on this, they argue insect welfare deserves a much higher priority. The next post we have is by Arepo, and it's called Modeling Civilization After a Catastrophe. The author here presents three models for expected loss of value in a global catastrophe that doesn't cause extinction. These three are, first, the cyclical model, second, the decay model, and third, perils model. Going in order, the cyclical model shows that once we have technology that can destroy us, we can either go extinct chained back to an earlier level of technology, for example, pre-industrial, or eventually progress to being multiplanetary and then interstellar. In the cyclical model, given an interstellar status, that would mean we would have more than one star system to occupy, inhabit, and that would lead to a massive increase in existential security for our species. At any earlier stage than interstellar, we would still have a risk of extinction. The decay model is very similar to the cyclical model, but every time we chain back to an earlier level of technology due to a catastrophe, our chance of extinction before getting back up to the previous level rises massively. The model allows for different decay rates, which are things like how much that chance rises or the overall risk increases. The perils model is quite similar to the cyclical model and the decay model. However, it has the key difference that within any given stage, the risk of extinction is related to factors other than just time in that stage. For instance, the number of planets we inhabit or the state of relevant technologies. After feedback in the comments, the author intends to make these models into a calculator where parameters can be plugged in to see the probability of humanity making it safe to the interstellar stage. And moving on to the opportunities section of the podcast. First, we have Rethink Priorities Special Projects Team is hiring, which is an announcement made by Rachel Norman, Cristiano Schmitz-Ibanez, and Meryl Alama. And this is announcing Rethink Priorities Special Projects Team, which provides fiscal sponsorship and operational support to, for the most part, long-termist mega projects. And they are hiring. Specifically, they're looking for managers and associates, and they also welcome applicants from anywhere in the world. Applications are due November 13th, or you can also join the AMA in the comment section to learn more. And next we have an announcement that every.org is donation matching for any monthly donations. This was announced by two different posts, one by Colin O'Keefe and one by William Keeley. So this is that from November 1st through November 30th, or until funds run out, any donor who sets up a monthly donation to a nonprofit will be matched up to $50 of their monthly donation for the first 2 months. This can be done up to three different times with three different nonprofits, and the process takes around 5 minutes, and you can find more detail on it on their website. The next opportunity is being announced by Giving What We Can, as well as Grace Adams, and it's a major update to the Effective Altruism Giving Tuesday. This is more of a meta announcement that there is a significant change to their annual Giving Tuesday donation matching scheme. So the announcement specifically is saying that only reoccurring donations will be matched and only up to $100 per user of X charity combinations. Because of this, both competition and payoff is likely to be lower, and the previous level of coordination between EAs seems unnecessary. The giving starts November 15th, and the EA Giving Tuesday team suggests those interested look through participating effective charities and donate directly via Facebook. Further instructions can be found in their article. And next we have a post called Who Underrates Their Likelihood of Success? Why Applying is Worthwhile by Steve Thompson and Kylie Abel. Applications for Charity Entrepreneurship's early 2023 incubation program have been extended through the end of November 10th. If they don't find more potential founders, they may not be able to launch charities in tobacco taxation and fish welfare. While they received around 3,000 applications, 80% are from outside the EA community and lack understanding of what they do. Those without all the relevant skills, e.g. business, research, interpersonal, etc., professional experience, or who are new to EA, often underestimate their chances. The best way to test fit and build skills is through the program, the authors argue, and founders also take a wide range of salaries, so that doesn't need to be a barrier. And next we have an article called AI Safety Needs Great Product Builders by Good Gravy. Great EA forum name, by the way. Product builders, things like web developers, project managers, designers, founders, developers, software engineers, etc., can contribute to AI safety in really tangible ways without ML or AI experience. To this end, the author gives some examples from their use cases. The first is ICE, an interactive visualizer to understand factored cognition that needs both back-end developers, for example, people to help instrument the cognition recipes, as well as front-end or UI/UX developers, people to help better visually represent the work that ICE is trying to achieve. Next, we have Elicit, the AI research assistant. Elicit needs more product managers to help make day-to-day decisions that can balance proving the usefulness of the app and providing a safer approach than other companies. Next, we have infrastructure engineers that are needed to insert abstraction between code and ML models that can help with implementation for iterative distillation as well as amplification. Check out the original author's post if you're interested in seeing some of the several roles that are open across these areas. And next, we have Michael as well as Drew Spartz announcing the most important Sentry writing prize. Superlinear is offering $500 each to write-ups that meaningfully critique, comment on, or build on the most important Sentry series. They expect to award most good faith submissions, and there's currently no submission deadline. And next, for community and media announcements, once again, we want to push the EA survey for 2022. This is again announced by David Moss and Willem Sliegers. Again, this is a really important annual survey of the effective altruism community that Rethink Priority, as well as other folks in the community, use to help improve what we're trying to do here, which is, of course, doing the most good we can. The link is due on the 1st of December. The survey is due the 1st of December. And the results inform the decisions on a number of different organizations and can really help us understand how the community is changing over time. It should take only about 10 minutes. It's a lot shorter than 2021's. If you're hearing my voice right now, chances are you're the target audience for this, and your response is extremely valuable. You can find the link down below on whatever platform you're listening to this podcast on. And next, we have an article called Supporting Online Connections, What I Learned After Trying to Find Impactful Opportunities, by Clifford and Sarah Sheng. The authors, both from the Center for Effective Altruism, spent 4+ months exploring how the forum could help people make valuable connections. 12 ideas were investigated, including services to get advice from experts, connect with those nearby or with similar interests, advertise / recruitment for, or find, assess impacts of jobs, and also options and ideas relating to targeting pain points for community builders and regranters. The most promising of these was the advertising jobs list. Oftentimes, as any EA can attest, projects that start off on one leg might get you to a place you weren't expecting, and that's exactly what happened here. Because the authors note that off the back of this work, they're the most excited not about the number of connections they made, but about high-value outcomes that have come from this project. These are things like jobs and collaborations. And next we have Ramaditha responding to a critique of long-termism by popular YouTube science channel Sabine Hulsenfelder. That video in question being called Elon Musk and the Long-Termists. What is their plan? A popular science channel host, Sabine Hulsenfelder, posted a video critique of long-termism. The author agrees with some points, things like key philosophers are mainly located at Oxford or related prestigious institutions, and population ethics being a key part of the argument. But the author does disagree with many of the other claims made, which primarily paint long-termists as not caring about the current issues or death of people today, or being overly optimistic about technology, or allowing tech and finance and philosophy elites to discard human welfare. The author also suggests that the discussion in the comment section focus on how best to respond to these types of critiques. So the next post we have is once again by a repo. It's called Long-Termist Terminology Has Biasing Assumptions. Long-termist terminology can fall victim to a few different areas of issues. Some of the most common ones are things like biasing towards certain population ethics, or vague or just not very precise language. Within the first category of biasing towards certain population ethics, it's not exactly a bad thing as long as the set of ideas are explicit about what population ethics they're biasing towards, which terms like existential catastrophe or suffering catastrophes both aren't defined in ways that exactly explicitly denote what population ethics they're pulling from or biased towards. In the case of the definition of existential catastrophe, it includes failed continuation risks alongside extinction. This implies a reduction in total population over long time frames is very, very bad. Additional bias is that suffering catastrophes is dependent on population ethics. Some people may claim any suffering on any scale is a catastrophe, even in an otherwise great world. In terms of lacking precision or being a bit too vague, definitions like global catastrophe aren't exactly always defined the best. However, we do have more rigid definitions here. One definition by the UN and also by Bolstrom and Cerkovic is, quote, a catastrophe that caused 10 million fatalities or $10 trillion worth of economic loss. In this regard, COVID meets this definition, but it isn't considered a global catastrophe by most long-termists. Moving on from inaccurate usage of these terms perhaps being the issue of this critique, next, we have recovery. This can sometimes mean recovering current technological levels. Sometimes it can also mean retaining potential to be a safe, a space-faring civilization. That being, of course, because of the value for existential security that being interstellar would grant us. The author argues we should aim to make long-termist terminology more formally defined, intuitive, precise, and ensure that there are categorical distinctions only for qualitatively different states, not different places on the same scale, which can be quite confusing, and as we saw in the lacking precision section, pretty vague at times. And next we have a piece of advice from Nick Servino called the Inside Out model for pitching EA. When pitching EA to those unfamiliar, start out by applying it within the cause area they care about. These are things like comparing effectiveness of different climate change interventions, for example. Later, you can transition to comparing across different cause areas. This helps to create a more welcoming feeling, and as I always say, it also helps to meet them where they're at more effectively. And the final post for the day is Mildly Against Donor Lotteries by Jeff Kaufman. Donor lotteries are where everyone puts in X dollars and a random person is chosen to donate the lot. They therefore do in-depth research on where to donate because it's worth it for the larger amount. However, it has some major downsides. If describing these decisions to others, for example, a friend interested in where to donate, you are less able to give object-level advice, and it could look to them like you gambled away your donation. It's also unlikely the chosen donor is able to beat existing research like GiveWell or Effective Altruism funds via individual effort alone, even with the extra motivation of a larger pot of money. And there you have it, the Effective Altruism Form Weekly from the 31st of October through the 6th of November, 2022. Thank you again to Zoe, and thank you to the rest of the team. My name is once again Colin Snell, and I hope you guys have a wonderful rest of your week. And as always, please continue to dig in deep and figure out the best ways you can do good, and importantly, build a system of meaning around that work, because meaning motivates. All right, I'll see you guys next week.